Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
All I do when I walk into someone's kitchen is try and steal recipes. That's my only goal when I see either a chef or a restaurant. I just go in there and I try.
So you lead the nation in cultural appropriation.
I am the number one cultural. I mean, this entire book, the recipes are all based on experiences that I have from other cultures, and I kind of lend my own sort of twist to. Having said that, I think appropriation is about stealing. And the opposite of appropriation is collaboration, which is about sharing. And so hopefully we do it from a standpoint of respect, meaningfulness, and we give credit where credit is due.
We're back with chef, writer, and Emmy-nominated TV personality Edward Lee, the author of the terrific new book, Buttermilk Graffiti. It's not just a great chef memoir, it's just a great book.
Thank you.
I'm tackling a memoir now, and it's a daunting task. Mm-hmm. It's really difficult and wonderful, often at the same moment. Mm-hmm. But first of all, I have to say, it's not just because there's a picture of a Mustang convertible on the cover. You really like the drive. What's up with that? You're from Canarsie. People from Canarsie do not like to drive.
You know, well, actually, no, I don't like to drive. I find myself, I have to drive. It's a weird thing. I actually don't like driving.
Got it.
But there's something about being in a car alone for long distances that you know, gives you a lot of headspace to think and ponder a lot of things.
Got it. All right. But also the other thing that made me laugh was your descriptions of your road trips when you're eating six meals in a day, you're buying raw ingredients that you can't possibly cook, and you're ordering so much food. And I used to say that my wife would say, you know, the back seat of our car looks like a styrofoam graveyard. The back seat of your car, if there was, looked like a styrofoam graveyard.
Yes. But I think anyone who is truly passionate about food, not even a chef, but anyone who's truly passionate about food sympathizes with this thing.
Yeah.
I can't just order one main course. I know I'm not going to eat it all.
No.
But I have to order three things. So yeah, when's the next time I'm going to be here?
Tom Douglas. Yeah. You know Tom Douglas,
yeah,
chef
course,
in Seattle. First time I ever went out to dinner with him, we were at Lydia Shire's restaurant, Biba, in Boston. He literally, we sat down, and he says to the server, "We'd like the entire menu." And I was like, "You're kidding, right?" He says, "No, this is R&D, dude. What are we going to do?"
Yeah.
No, so it's weird. So talk about the book. The title says a lot, Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine. But talk a little bit about how you conceived of the book and why you felt the need to write it.
The actual seed of the book came when I was on book tour. For my first book, Smoke and Pickles.
Which is a more traditional cookbook.
More traditional, and with stories. I know a lot about the world, but I hadn't traveled. You know, traveling on a tour where you're in a different city every single day, or which seems like an endless period of time, is a very different kind of travel than like going to Seattle, coming home, waiting 3 months. Going to Texas, coming home.
For sure.
You just, the differences in our cultures in America are just so apparent when you're in Minneapolis one day and New Orleans the next. And so when I was on that book tour, I just, you know, for the first time in my life, I was traveling to a lot of cities I'd never been to before, first of all. But I also was like, just sat there and go, you know, what binds us together as Americans? What makes the person from New Orleans and from Maine and from Michigan and from Seattle and Southern California, what makes us all? Is there one thing that kind of binds us together and that we can say? And it's a question that you know, increasingly I thought, no, there's not. We eat very differently. We have very different cultures. We have different tribes, act very differently. And yet we all call ourselves Americans. Right. And so that was my initial curiosity. And one of the answers that I came up with was our need for diversity. Right. We're one of the only countries where, you know, you can wake up and have a Jewish breakfast and have Indian food for lunch.
And a Nigerian dinner.
And yeah. And it's not weird. That's just how we do it. And we have Italian the next day, and then we'll have a kielbasa, then, you know, and it's just we constantly demand diversity in our meals. You know, I was in Italy a couple of years ago with a friend's wedding, so we had to stay in this one town for like 7 days. I'll forget the town, but it was where they make pesto, right? So for the first 2 days, I was in heaven because I was sitting there. It was the best pesto I've ever eaten. And by the third day, I said, hey, anyone know where a Chinese restaurant here in this town is? Because I'm done with pesto. You know, after six meals of pesto, I'm done. And everyone's like, no. And I ended up ate pesto for 7 days, and I could not get out of that town fast enough.
Were you outside Genoa somewhere?
Yeah. We were. It was like a seaside. It was like right on the coast.
Got it. On the
western shore. But, you know, and subsequently, everywhere I go to Korea, I'm like, I'm done with noodles. Can we get some pizza in here? And one of the things that I really wanted to write this book to celebrate the diversity of food that we have in America, but also to understand, like, that's our strength. That's what we have in common, is that we all love to eat these crazy combinations of food. And that's what it means for me anyway, to be American. Just from a food lens, I also wanted to write about a lot of these immigrant cuisines that we don't see a lot of. Some we have, like Middle Eastern food. Like, I've eaten hummus my whole life, but I honestly don't know a lot about Islam or the Muslim culture.
Right.
So some foods I just wanted to delve more deeply into. And then there were others like Nigerian food, which I know is going to be the next big cuisine in America. And it's just sort of percolating right now, you know, under the radar. But there's a neighborhood in Houston, for example. It's the largest Nigerian population in America. The restaurants there are incredible. And I wanted to sort of see it firsthand. And the best thing about it is I say, you know, I probably touch 20 or 30 different cultures in this book, you know, different
food cultures.
No, it
was amazing. And we're not the typical cultures that people write about in road trips.
And I never had to take my passport out once.
Wow, that's awesome. You actually answered maybe the question of what the book's about. There's a quote that I love, which is, I cannot eat a dish without wondering who cooked it and what her story is. There is always more to the story than the ingredients on the cutting board. So much of what we think of as traditional American cuisine is being challenged. We are witnessing a reshaping of the food landscape, and it is thrilling to some, obscene to others. But that is when it becomes interesting, when the tension between two vastly different cultures creates something new. I mean, you talk about Cambodian food, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You talk about Middle Eastern food in Dearborn, Michigan, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. or in a shocker, you talk about pastrami in Indianapolis as a way to talk about race relations mm-hmm. in Indianapolis. Yeah. And I love that. I love that you're using food as a metaphor in every chapter in the book in unusual ways, because you're not going to the typical places. Mm-hmm.
And I love that you brought up the Indianapolis chapter, because it is so true. You know, I go there because of this Jewish deli, which, by the way, is a fantastic Jewish deli.
Do they really make their own pastrami? Because very few people make their own pastrami. As you know, it's really hard.
Yes, and they do. And it's fantastic. And it's
Shapiro's.
It's spectacular. And you know, but they don't get the attention necessarily, because it's not your typical— Indianapolis is not your typical center of Jewish culture, you know.
Right.
But there's a reason why they— and so you do. I start asking questions, why is there such a Jewish— this is an incredible Jewish deli in the heart of Indianapolis. Well, you start looking at the history of it, and then you start asking more questions. And there's this incredible history of race relations in Indianapolis. And it's, again, it starts with the food. I could have ended my research at the pastrami recipe and just stopped, but I asked one more question, and that led me to this whole other history of Indianapolis.
And then you talked about the history of African-American mechanics and African-American racing, and it was just astonishing the way you connected pastrami to wheelies.
Yeah. But if you go there and you it is a natural conclusion when you go there and you see it all happening. You know, there is this idea, I guess, in conventional food writing, that you stick to the food and everything else gets parsed out. And one of the things that I know for sure is that in an age of the internet, an age of, you know, I can go on the internet and Google pastrami recipe or gazpacho recipe or hummus recipe and just take any food out of its context, out of its culture, and just download a recipe and make it and eat it. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not judging anyone. But in an era that's what we do, we are losing context at a rapid pace. We are losing origin stories. We're losing connections. We're losing human stories. And to me, when I went for pastrami, but I heard about these incredible stories about race relations, I thought, how can I not include this in the book?
Yeah.
How can I not? This is part of the story.
It is. It's a huge part of the story. And, you know, we have a mutual friend, John T. Edge.
Yes.
And you know, I wrote a book about New York food seen through this perspective back in 1991. And then John T. wrote his first book through this same lens, this sort of sociocultural political lens called Southern Belly. And he even told me, he said, you know, Southern Belly was inspired by New York Eats. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there are a lot of people who have now started to see that eating food or cooking food out of context is, it's not that it's, it can't be a satisfying experience, but it's not as special as if you understand more about the context.
It's a little bit hollow. And I don't mean that as a judgment, but it's just eating for the food. You know, one of the first chapter of the book that I wrote, and it's not the first chapter in the book, but it's about the Cambodians in Lowell, Massachusetts. And I'd heard about this for a long time, that Cambodians were taking over Lowell, Massachusetts. And Lowell, Massachusetts is basically an old dying factory town, predominantly a mill town. And now 40% of the population is Cambodian. Used to be Irish, Polish, Italian, Lithuanian, Greek, you know, all of that you know, older generation of immigrants. So I go over there and I'm spending, you know, a week there, and I spend time with this. I meet this one great Cambodian chef. He goes by the name Sam, and we're cooking and eating and just spending a great old time together. And one afternoon I'm driving, and I happen upon this old boxing gym, you know, Romalo's West End Gym. And I go inside. I love boxing. So I go inside and I see all these pictures of Mark Wahlberg and Christian Bale. Well, that's where they shot the movie The Fighter, which is about two Lowell Irish boxers. And I thought, oh, my God, of course. I love that movie. And it's just, I never made that connection because I was so deeply embedded in the Cambodian world. And the one guy said to me, listen, you know, the Irish boxers aren't here anymore. It's mostly Latinos and African-Americans who are, you know, in the gym. He said, if you want some history of boxing, got to go see this guy, Irish Jack Brady. He owns a bar. So I go there, and it was really funny. I go in the afternoon. I said, he's not here. I said, can I leave my phone number for him? And the bartender said, no, he doesn't use telephones, so you have to come back. You know, which is so, I love it. It's
I
so,
love
like,
that.
You have to come back at 10 o'clock, and he may or may not be here. End up coming back, and he was very cordial and sat me down, and we drank Irish whiskey together, and we sat up till 2 a.m., trading story, mostly him talking and me listening and writing. And it was at that moment that I realized that the story of the Cambodian chef isn't complete unless I tell the story of the Irish boxer. Because the two of them, to me, and it's funny, the Irish boxer won't go to the Cambodian restaurant.
Right.
And the Cambodian chef's not going to go to the Irish bar. But to me, they're linked together forever in the history of Lowell. And to me, that's a microcosm of America, where we all of us kind of live in this very complex soup where none of us kind of fully assimilate or fully integrate, but we also aren't completely separated either. We're like a chunky soup, right? Where we kind of, the things are still kind of distinguishable, but we also meld into this other thing. And so we're connected in that way. And there's always one group sort of, you know, fading away or assimilating, and another group coming in and struggling. And we just, it's this constant, endless, like, wave of rising and falling.
Yeah,
and,
for sure.
You know, how those tensions collide. And sometimes they collide harmoniously. Sometimes they're violent. Sometimes they're just, you know, it's all in between.
Yeah.
And that's the story of American food, you know? Yeah.
So let's talk about what specifically happened in Indianapolis, because Shapiro's is in what is now an African-American neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. You know, Indianapolis, you know, we're talking, you know, the migration, right, of African-Americans from the South moving up to the North, you know, post-slavery. At the same time, you have workers moving westward. And Indianapolis becomes this very odd, by chance, sort of neutral ground in the middle. And so you have this community that develops where, you know, African-Americans who stop in Indianapolis before making the final move to Chicago, They find work there and they end up saying, hey, it's not bad here, and they end up staying. A lot of migrant workers from the East come over and find the same kind of, you know, work, and they decide to stay, factory jobs. And then you have Jewish people who decide, you know, at the time, too, there was way overcrowding in New York City. And so people were looking for other places to find opportunities. And there was an opportunity in Indianapolis, particularly in the scrap metal business. And so you have this weird community of, like, Italians, Jewish people, and Black people who lived in this area of Indianapolis. And it was very peaceful. It was very harmonious. Everyone got along. Everyone remembers it. You know, I ran into a number of older people who had lived there as kids, and they all said the same thing. So we remembered it very fondly. We all played with each other's kids. We all respected each other. We were all merchants. There was no upper class milk. We were all merchants just struggling to survive. And it became this very, you know, almost like a utopia of race relations, which is very odd to find that in Indianapolis.
Right.
Because historically, Indianapolis, other parts of Indianapolis have not been, you know, the most tolerant place in the world. And it was a very interesting, and also, you know, at the end, it's very sad. What happens is they decide to build a highway right through the middle of that neighborhood, and it ends up everyone just moves out of the neighborhood. And so, whereas you have in other sort of cultures where, again, one group assimilates, moves out, but another group comes in, no one ever came in. And because of the highway, it just completely fractured the neighborhood. And so what you have now is basically a ghost town.
And Shapiro's
right in the middle of it. And you go and you go, well, this place is not going to be busy because there's absolutely nothing around here. And you walk in and it's packed, and it's 300 people, and it just, yeah. And there is, you know, Shapiro's has been there for over 100 years. There is some memory of it. And so there are Latinos, there are Black people, there are Jewish people, there are white people, there's every creed and color of people go to Shapiro's every single day. And it's this really wonderful place in the middle of nowhere.
It's a little bit like Katz's is in New York.
Yeah, it's very much so. Very much so. And you know, to hear the owner, you know, who's now, I believe, fourth generation owner from the same Shapiro family, talk about the food, talk about the recipes, talk about, you know, and it was something he said to me, which, you know, because he's sussy. He said, "You're a chef, aren't you?" I said, yeah, I'm a chef. And he said, you know, he said, we don't have a chef here. We're not cooking chef recipes. You know, we're cooking a family heritage recipes. We're cooking traditions." And he said something really interesting. He said, you know, your restaurant will only survive as long as your trend lasts, as long as your whimsy lasts. This, you know, our restaurant can go on forever.
Wow.
Because we're cooking traditions. And those things never die.
Yeah.
And you know, I sat there and said, you know, you're right.
you have really trenchant observations about assimilation. You know, when you were writing about Dearborn, you mm-hmm. said that does everything have to be assimilated to yeah. be American? Can we learn to respect the distinct lines of a culture that does not want to be like us? Mm-hmm. I hope so, because as much as I love pizza and chanterelle hummus, I also want to know that I can go into a restaurant in Dearborn that will serve me a boiled lamb's head, teeth and all, as if it were the most natural thing to eat for lunch.
What we think of as odd is not odd to them, you know? And I don't want to lose that. I don't want everything to be so homogenized and so, you know, middle of the road and
yeah.
so safe.
And I love when you go to Clarksdale, Mississippi, where mm-hmm. I have been, because mm-hmm. Whenever I would go to the Southern Foodways Conference,
yes.
I would always stop there. And you say that you went to a juke joint and there was a blues guitarist. You said he's bending a sappy Sting song to say things profane. And then you said it reminds me of the food of Clarksdale, Italian, Lebanese, barbecue, Mexican, soul food, Chinese, some of it authentic, some not. It all bends to serve the community. And you're not a snob.
No.
You know, in fact, you're the opposite of a snob. I did worry a little bit that the story was enough and that the food didn't have to be delicious. Like when I wrote mm-hmm. New York mm-hmm. Eats, I was like, a great story could get you halfway there, but the food had to be good.
Yeah.
It wasn't because you often you describe a lot of the food as it wasn't so good.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was okay in the service of the story, I guess, you wanted to tell.
Yeah, and there was one story in particular that I tell, and I tell a lot now, is eating the pepperoni roll in Appalachia.
It's the food of West Virginia.
Yeah, yeah. You know, legendary tales about the pepperoni roll and going there and going, being so damn underwhelmed by this thing, which is just a pepperoni stick and, you know, undersalted bread. And I thought, this is such a waste of time. Why did I drive all this way out here? And yes, you're right. There's nothing culinary fabulous about that. But if you know, the way Ronnie Lundy, a very famous Appalachian food writer,
who's a fantastic writer,
amazing. She said to me, and she has this power to make things crystal clear and to make me feel stupid at the same time. She said to me, you know, this food wasn't invented for your whimsy. You know, this food was invented for an Italian coal miner who had to spend 12 to 18 hours in a dark cave and who may not come home that day, and whose only connection to the outside world and to his family and to his heritage back in Italy was this one piece of portable meal that he could eat at room temperature.
It's like an Italian pasty.
Yeah. So basically she said, screw you and your underwhelmed opinions. There's something very important up here. And I saw it really for the first time when she said that is, yes, some of these foods are very bland. They're very boring, if you will. But if we don't keep that touchstone of where our foods come from, then we also don't know how to make things flavorful.
Yeah.
And so we need to keep those things. And, you know, it's one of the things that I find really interesting in this age that we're in, where everything is packed with flavor and there's 14 garnishes and everything has to have, you know, a hybrid of something and something. A lot of the foods I eat when I'm researching something very, very traditional, whether it's a very traditional Italian dish in Italy or a Korean food or Japanese food, anything that was eaten by our grandparents' generation, to my palate, is very bland. It's very bland food. And so we think, well, that food can be improved upon, you know, because I'm going to add more spice and more togarashi, and I'm going to throw this on there and furikake. But they didn't need that. And so it's a function of our psyche today. I don't know what it is, but we demand 14 layers of flavor and everything.
Right.
They didn't. So to say it's bland is really just a reflection of our generation and what we are demanding in our food versus it really being bland, because there was an entire generation of people that grew up on this food and were perfectly happy with
it. Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because that brings up this notion of tradition and authority. And you wrote, the danger with tradition is when it is given authority, when it demands authenticity. Words such as true, genuine, and real will then quickly enter the discussion. And you regard that as problematic.
Oh, I regard them as fascism, to be very frank about it. You know, what I hate the most is, you know, I every once in a while I'll pick up a Southern cookbook, you know, and it says authentic recipes from the South. And what authenticity are you talking about, right? If you're talking about the 1850s, it's mostly European food, right? If you're talking about, you know, post-slavery, you start to get the African influence into Southern food, right? And you talk about the Paula Deen South, if you will, right, which is basically just a caricature of a Southern food, and everything's fat and buttered, right? And we're living in a sort of a post-Paula Deen era where we're sort of reaching back. But really, here's the thing, Paula Deen is not irrelevant. It's just it was a time and a place. It was a post-industrial industrial food world that we were coming out of, and Paula Deen just kind of took it all together and threw 10 pounds of butter and everything and made it popular. So depending on what era or period you're talking about, you know, that food is just as valid as any other era. So when you say authentic recipes from the South, I'm always like, well, what? Tell me what era you're talking about, and I'll tell you if it's authentic or not. But something from 1820 is just as valid as something from 2015. It's just a period that we live in. And to me, what we're living in right now is the South embracing sort of, you know, what some people are calling the immigrant South, or the South embracing this diversity of culture, where you see we're acknowledging Mexican, you know, culture and Southern food, Lebanese, you know, the Vietnamese in Texas and Louisiana, all of these immigrant cultures all trickled all throughout the South that are having influences in the food. And we are seeing the landscape of Southern food actually change. And Southern food was never a monoculture, right? And that's the one big misperception that I always get, that the more I study and the more I read up on and experience Southern food. Southern food, people always say, well, Southern food is this monoculture and it's all white people making it. It never was. It really never was. It was always this incredible grand experiment in African, you know, African ingredients and cooking techniques mixed with European sensibilities, mixed with Native American agriculture. And then you throw the West Indies, you throw the spice trade from Asia, you have barbecue rubs coming from. I mean, it's always been this incredible.
So it's all fusion with a small F food.
Yes, it always was. And so at some point we kind of painted it as this monoculture, but it never was, you know. And so, again, those words like authentic to me reek of, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to just ignore all the rest of the history, just point to one era. And call that authentic.
Yeah, it's weird. You know, I wrote a whole book on pizza, and I talk about VPN, you know, and I talk about them being the chiefs of the pizza police, you know, and it's just like, and there's only one way to make, there's only one flour to use, and there's one oven to use, and there's one kind of cheese to use, and one kind of tomatoes. It's like, who said that?
Right. And you, I can guarantee, I bet you $1 million there's some, you know, Sicilian grandmother, you know, sticking her middle finger up at them going, F you.
Exactly.
I make my pizza just the way I want it, and it's just fine.
I should say that VPN stands for Vera Pizza Napolitana.
Yeah, that's it.
And it's, I actually met with Pepe, who started it, and I was just like, this guy is scaring me. Yeah. And then I got a lot of shit when the book came out, Pizza Slice of Heaven, because I said that the best pizza in the world is not in Naples. Yeah. And it was in Phoenix.
Yeah.
It was Chris Bianco's.
If you've never been, you should go.
Yeah. It's awesome. Yeah. So where do you come out on this whole cultural appropriation issue when it comes to food?
We have always appropriated other cultures when it comes to food. Historically, that is cuisine, right? So American cuisine is an appropriation of many, many different cultures. You know, Thai cuisine is an appropriation of many different cultures. That is historically how food transforms and changes over time. Personally, all I do when I walk into someone's kitchen is try and steal recipes. That's my only goal when I see either a chef or a restaurant. I just go in there and I try.
So you lead the nation in cultural appropriation.
I am the number one cultural. I mean, this entire book, the recipes are all based on experiences that I have from other cultures. And I kind of, you know, some are traditional recipes, but some I sort of lend my own sort of twist to. Having said that, I think, listen, appropriation is about stealing, you know, and the opposite of appropriation is collaboration, which is about sharing. And so hopefully we do it from a standpoint of respect, from a standpoint of meaningfulness, and we give credit where credit is due. But how boring would this world be if we were only allowed to cook the food of our own heritage.
Oh, my God. If I only got to eat the food that my mother served, we'd be in trouble.
We'd all be in trouble. And it would be a very, very boring place. And so we need this. We need to, you know, and again, I don't use the word appropriate, but we share recipes. We share, just like scientists do. We share things. There is a common pool of knowledge. And we all throw our hats in that pool, and we're allowed to do whatever we want with it.
Yeah.
That's the ultimate. Now, if some girl in Portland is profiting off a Mexican tortilla recipe, well, I can't make the world a fair place. And maybe those people should have been a bit more respectful in how they did it. But the idea of going to Mexico, learning recipes, coming back here and opening a restaurant, it has been done from time beginning. That is what we do. I go to countries all over the globe and I try and absorb as much information as possible. And when it's appropriate, yeah, I make them in my restaurant.
I know. I always think it's weird that, you know, there are all these problems on college campuses when Chinese American students complain that the Kung Po chicken mm-hmm. is being made very badly mm-hmm. in the dining room. And it's mm-hmm. like, it's college food. It's yeah. all being made badly, regardless of its ethnic right, origins.
Right. The pastrami also is awful.
And so is the matzo ball soup. Yeah. And so is everything that they make.
And again, it goes back to this idea that we are still, in 2018, fumbling around for our identities. And what we do, which I find really fascinating, is that we give up some of our, you know, motherland identity to become American. And then we also try and hold on to something as well.
Yeah.
And when people get offended by this, it is what I see when they do that. It is their attempt to hold on to something so dear to them, which usually is food. You know, my wife is German, seven or eight generations German, right? So no one in her family speaks German. No one wears lederhosen. No one has in her family alive has been to Germany. So they know nothing about the culture. Do you know what they do every fall? They grow cabbage in their backyard and they make sauerkraut from scratch.
Yes. In fact, did you bring me some sauerkraut?
No, I didn't. Sorry.
Okay. Come on, man.
I didn't have to check back. You know, when we come here from wherever we came from, we lose language, we lose rituals, we lose history, we usually lose religion at some point, we lose it all. The last thing we lose before we completely erase that culture is our food. We
yeah.
hold on to that the most. And so I understand when people get offended by the Kung Pao chicken or the, you know, the pastrami, because that is so it may be the last thing you have
right.
that allows you to hold on to some semblance of an identity in China and Nigeria and Turkey and Greece or wherever. And so it's so precious to them. When someone comes up and says, hey, I got a gyro and I'm going to put some sriracha on it, of course you get offended.
Like right.
It's stomping on something that's so precious.
Yeah. And I get offended because if it tastes bad, you know.
That's a whole other discussion. But I'm offended every day of my life.
And for you, by the way, the kimchi was the glue. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. All the fermented things that your grandmother was putting up.
And I always say too, you know, like you know, my wife is German heritage. My daughters will speak less Korean than I do. I don't even speak that great. Her daughter will speak probably no Korean.
Right.
But I can goddamn definitely, you know, promise you that my granddaughter will be eating kimchi.
So now it's time for the special sauce all-you-can-answer buffet. You know,
okay.
We don't have a clock. We don't have a sound. So who's at your last supper? No family allowed, can be living or dead. Just people you think would be really fun to hang out with. Could be artists, musicians, politicians.
So my last supper is, living or dead, is Jim Harrison, who you know, died somewhat recently.
Mm-hmm.
And two times I had the opportunity to meet him, and two times it was, you know, either canceled or schedule changed at the last minute. And actually, he was supposed to be on the Mind of a Chef series that I did, but he got very ill right before. And so literally we had everything packed and we were on our way to Arizona.
So he would have to be there.
He would definitely have to be there. And I honestly think if he were there, I would need nothing more than you know, a bottle of wine, you know, something to smoke and some really fatty goose. And I'd be happy.
Nobody else would have to be there? Just the two of you?
Oh, yeah. I would just want the two of us.
It would
definitely be
a serious
bromance thing.
Why do you like Jim so much?
Number one, he was a great writer.
Yes, he was.
And I never know if it's a past or present
right.
tense. He's a great writer. And to me, it's writing about food is great, but to me, his writing is so seductive. It's so guttural. It's so visceral. It's so present. And he always takes me to a place of seduction. I'm always seduced by the language and where he takes me to. And that, to me, primarily is beautiful. The other thing that Jim Harrison does is he painted a world, and it was a very fancy, and he would always name drop and all these fancy people, but he created a world that was also very inclusive, and it was also very tender. you know, and it wasn't just about I'm a glutton and I'm this gargantuan sort of hedonism. It was also at the same. It was balanced with a humor, mm-hmm. Which I love, a tenderness, and it was very inclusive. And it was just about sort of listen. It's all about the food and the culture and the beauty of it, and it was always uplifting. It was always uplifting, even in its sort of most
even tragic, its most
dismal,
debauched, yes. Debauched way. So you're just eating goose?
Yes, goose, lots of red wine, whiskey, and any other fatty thing that we can get. You know, I want to reproduce. There's a passage of this epic lunch that he ate with Orson Welles, and it's like, you know, 14 courses deep.
Right.
And it's all just right. And it's just lunch.
So what are you guys listening to?
Oh, my goodness. Neil Young.
Any record in particular?
Just a whole, just front to back.
Okay.
Everything.
All right.
From the very beginning to the very end.
And that's it.
And then Neil Young comes in at the end and just like serenades us.
You have this in, you. Were you practicing? Well, that's pretty cool.
No.
So do you have guilty pleasures?
I don't have guilty pleasures because I don't feel guilty about eating anything.
I knew you were going to say that.
So I don't.
Okay.
But, you know, it's...
That's
it's
fair.
Cool Ranch Doritos is probably my low point. You know, it's the thing that I'm...
Or your high point, depending
high
upon
point,
where you are.
On, you know.
So three books that have influenced your life.
The first serious book I ever picked up. And this is kind of a longer story, but you know, back in the old days, you used to have these like kind of like Nancy Drew Hardy Boys, and there would be little coupons when you got to the back of the book, and you would literally fold up a dollar. You could send cash back then and send away. And I was reading some book, and it was weird. It was this book for Dante's Inferno, and it was a poet's journey through hell. And I thought it was a comic, because I was reading a comic book, and I thought, oh my God, this is really cool. So I sent away for it, and I got Dante's Inferno, and I opened it up, and I said, it's a book of poetry. And it was actually the English translation and the original Italian on the other side.
And you loved it. And,
no, I didn't read it. I said, This is garbage. I was 14. I'm not going to read this.
Right.
So I put it away, and I got sick. I got a hepatitis. And I was sick in bed for like 12 days. And so, you know, it's just a point you run out of video games, you run out of things. And I picked up this book and I said, well, I'm going to read this stupid book. And it changed my life. And it was what started me reading. You know, and after that, I became a voracious reader. And I just read through everything.
Wow. So that's one.
That's one. I think the other one that influenced me as I was becoming a chef. You know, I was reading cookbooks, right? And I was reading Jacques Pepin, and I was reading all these technical cookbooks. And there was a woman I was dating at the time, I mentioned Clementine, and she was a really big fan of M.F.K. Fisher. And she said, well, you have to read Consider the Oyster. And I thought, well, that's a kind of a weird name for a book. When you don't consider an oyster, you shuck them and eat them. And, you know, it was a girly book, right? It was written by a woman, and it was written in this very sort of... not pompous, but a very elevated language.
I would say, and it's a little pompous.
Yeah, and it came from a very different place. But what it did for me was it brought me out of the kitchen, and it brought me to sort of this you know, this ether, this other world where food was not about commerce, and it was beautiful. It really just kind of opened my eyes to food writing, that you could write something so beautiful, that you could write an entire volume, though it's a small book, that you could write an entire book about an oyster. And at the end of the day, was it really about the oyster?
Yeah.
And that just kind of, you know, coupled with, you know, I also love to read. And so with that, it just opened my eyes to food in a way that I've always held dear, and I always still read her stuff even today.
That's great. It's, yeah. I'd love to see what the literary marriage between Dante and M.F.K. Fisher. So it's just been declared Ed Lee Day all over the world.
Oh, okay.
What's happening on that day?
Everyone is takes off of work. They go to their local mom and pop bodega or Vietnamese pho place, or Mexican taco, you know, nothing, no chain restaurants. You get a huge order of whatever it is. You go home. You get a nice, open up a nice bottle of whiskey, and you eat and you drink, and you read some Jim Harrison.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Ed Lee.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This has been fun.
Check out Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine, or eat at one of Ed's restaurants in Louisville, 610 Magnolia, Milkwood, or Whiskey Dry. So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time. Thank you. It was a pleasure, Ed.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.